Today's Taisho will be on case 19. Sorry. Today's Taisho will be on case 30 in the Mumwonkan. Case 30 is entitled Basso's This Very Mind is the Buddha. Dai Bai asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso answered, "This very mind is the Buddha." Mumwon's comment, "If you directly grasp Basso's meaning, you will wear the Buddha's clothes, eat the Buddha's food, speak the Buddha's words, do the Buddha's deeds. That is, you are the Buddha himself." However, alas, Dai Bai misled not a few people into taking the mark on the scale for the weight itself. How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? If a man of understanding hears anyone say, "This very mind is Buddha," he will cover his ears and rush away. Mumon's verse, "The blue sky and bright day, no more searching around. What is Buddha, you ask? With loot in your pocket, you declare yourself innocent." I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice Zen this morning. This is the first Saturday sit of our new year of 2019. And I'm very glad you could make it. It's a beautiful winter's day. And, you know, something made you get up and come here, or invited you to get up and come here. And I'm so glad you listened to that voice in yourself. People have a conscious mind, you know, that picks and chooses all the time, and that's where we spend most of our waking lives, right? You know, we. When I get up in the morning, I usually do some sitting. I usually do at least an hour. And then I come downstairs and I make a cup of tea and I have breakfast. And I try to decide if I want to have milk in my tea or not. Sometimes I add milk and sometimes I don't. And then I decide, what do I want for breakfast? And I have some... I always have some rice in the rice cooker, and sometimes I will have chickpeas with my rice and some soy sauce on that. And by the way, that is absolutely delicious, I would say. But sometimes I will have something else. I have some gluten-free waffles, and there's a couple other things I can eat for breakfast also. So, you know, I'll say basically, what do I want? What does Kurt want for breakfast? And then I'll give Kurt what he wants for breakfast. And then, if it's a day off, I can say, well, what does Kurt want to do today? And if I go to work, I have to go to work. I have to teach my classes and go to meetings. But I might say, what does Kurt want for lunch, and so on. And this is a perfectly normal thing. You know, I'm very glad to be me. You know, it's actually not always wonderful. It's sometimes pretty challenging to be a person, right? To be a person is to accept a whole set of social expectations, right? It means compromising in many ways with society, right? I mean, if you're going to be a person, you have to sort of accept society's definition of a person, and you have to try to live up to that definition. So there's a kind of a game aspect to this. I know that when I was in college, I was very thin, like really thin, and I wanted to be a little bit more muscular and stronger. So I actually used to go to the gym every day, and actually lift weights. It seemed like no matter how much I lifted my weights, I could never really sort of like bulk up and get any serious muscles, you know. And I was always exercising with these other guys in the boys' weight room, in the men's weight room, who were also college students, and some of them were even in some of my classes. And they would come in and they would pump iron for a while, and I would look in their muscles. You know, they had really nice muscles, you know, really good definition. And I would try to push myself and work with heavier weights. But no matter what I did, you know, I wasn't really gonna become a muscle man. So I was a little shy about myself, and I went to the gym to sort of meet that social expectation, right? You know, so I thought people expected me as a young man to be a little bit muscular. If I wanted to be liked by other people, I needed to bulk up a little bit. And, I tried my best, you know. So I think that's sort of what it means to be a self, right? You know, you have a certain role you're supposed to fill, and you try your best. And, you know, we have our good days and our bad days, right? You know, I'm a teacher and an English professor. So, you know, I went to a conference a week ago, and I had to give a paper. You know, and that's a social expectation too, you know. So the ideal is to, you know, come in, give your paper, and have everybody's jaw drop. And they come up to you and say, "My God, that was fantastic," right? Or you could give your paper and people will be, you know, very troubled by something you said, and they'll want to challenge you, and you can have a heated argument, which is also a kind of success, right? And sometimes you can give your paper and, you know, there's like three people in the room, and you give your paper and listen to the crickets. You know, there aren't really any crickets, but it's just not much of an event, right? So, you know, when you give your paper, you're filling a social role, and you want to get a certain kind of response, and maybe you do and maybe you don't. And every once in a while, you know, you'll give a paper that, you know, people really pay attention to and say, "This is really great." And, you know, more often than not, you give a paper and everybody goes, "Oh, thank you for that," you know. And they mean, "Thank you for presenting, you know, that was not a memorable paper." But, you know, you go and you do your best. It's like working out in the weight room. You're trying to get some muscles, and you give a paper and you do your best, and you're meeting social expectations. And it's important to meet those social expectations. It's important to be skillful at being a person, right? And you can be more or less skillful. You know, I'm a pretty good teacher. I play a teacher role when I go into a classroom, and I'm pretty skillful. You know, I get really good evaluations from my students, and my students come up to me and say, "You know, that was a really wonderful class. I really enjoyed your class," and that's even after I gave them their grade. So I feel that, you know, probably they did enjoy the class, and so I'm very skillful at being a teacher, and I'm pretty skillful in some of my other roles. But, you know, I'm still learning. You know, you're always learning, always trying to improve your performance. And this is what it means to be a person. You know, you're filling a set of roles. And, you know, you're making, you didn't necessarily choose those roles, right? They were given to you. And, you know, you decide, okay, I'm going to be an English teacher. And you go to school and you become an English teacher and you teach, and hopefully you become skillful at filling that identity, you know. Sometimes we find ourselves doing things, though, that we don't necessarily want to do, right? That happens too. So, you know, I had a friend of mine, he's still my good friend, you know, he became a neuroscientist, and you would think that that was the most wonderful thing in the world, but he all his life he's regretted that he didn't go into to another field, you know. He's very conflicted about the life he's led as a neuroscientist. His father was a very famous musician and music teacher. And my friend has always felt like maybe he missed the boat, he missed the opportunity by becoming a brain scientist. And you know, we feel conflicted sometimes about the roles we play because we don't always choose those roles. And if we choose them, you know, we still might feel conflicted. So, you know, that's part of life. You know, part of life is being a person, being Bob or being Susan. And, you know, people, you arrive on the scene, you don't get to choose your family, you're assigned a family. You don't get to decide what it means to be a son or a daughter. You don't get to decide what it means to be a professor or a mathematician. You know, those things, those roles are already there for you, and you do your best. You try to make them your own, and you try to perform skillfully. And a lot of life is just doing that, you know, we live in that world most of the time. But, you know, every once in a while, we discover that there's something inside of us that's not, that's different from that self, or that's more than that self, right? Some people, I will never forget when I first, you know, had my first experience out in the natural world. I was, I think, in the seventh grade or something, and I joined the Boy Scouts. And mostly I joined the Boy Scouts because all my friends were in the Scouts and my parents were pushing me to join the Boy Scouts, which was really something I didn't want to do. I was a nerdy little kid, and I liked to just hang out at the house and read, and I was really into science fiction. So I loved science fiction, and I very much liked Ursula Le Guin and Arthur C. Clarke. These are probably people nobody reads anymore. But I loved, my idea of a good day was just to lie down on my bed and just read a whole book for the day. So my parents wanted me to do something more physical, so they pushed me into Boy Scouts. And a lot of my friends were in Scouts. So, one of the first things I did in the Boy Scouts was go on a 50-mile hike. So I joined the Boy Scouts. My parents bought me a uniform. And the uniform is ridiculous in so many ways. It has you have these socks that go up to your knees, and there are these garters that hold your socks up, and there are little tassels on the garters. It's the weirdest thing. I think they've made them much more cool, but in those days they were very weird. And so we bought the uniform, and I went on this 50-mile hike, and it was really torture in so many ways. I was not in good physical shape, and the people who were running the hike, I really didn't know how to take it. It was really unrealistic to expect little kids to do a 50-mile hike. So on the day two of the hike, a lot of the little kids, myself and my friends, we were just unable to walk anymore. And I remember some people started just sobbing, right? And the scoutmaster realized that they'd made a big mistake, that, you know, people who are like 10 years old can't probably do a 50-mile hike. So they divided the troop up, and the older kids went on, and the younger kids stayed behind and camped. Now, we were up in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. And I'll never forget, you know, that was like a magical, magical experience for me. You know, it resonated with me so deeply, and it was so liberating to be up in those mountains. And, it was a challenge to be roughing it like that, you know, camping out. And I remember I ate some berries that I thought were blueberries, and I had an allergic reaction, and my face swelled up, and they were debating whether they should take me to the hospital or not. But it was okay, I made it through. But even though, you know, I had this allergic reaction, and my face was, I had a giant head from some kind of allergy, I had a wonderful time. And it really resonated with me. And it became something I've done all my life. You know, if somebody says, why do you hike? You know, it's not something that people really want me to do. It's not, there's really not a role hiker. I guess you could call yourself a hiker, but, you know, you don't get any salary for going on a hike. There's not any identity, there's no prestige, you know. It's just something that spoke to me so powerfully. And over the years, I have made a point of going hiking a lot, you know. And if you go hiking, if you get into like hiking in the mountains, I've hiked in the Tetons and in the Rockies, and, you know, the last really big hike I had was, we were walking for almost the whole day at a 45-degree angle. So physically very demanding, and maybe with a 40 or 50-pound pack. But you know, there's something just glorious about walking up a mountainside when it's covered with flowers and looking around and seeing the sky, you know, like hundreds of miles, unfolding for hundreds of miles. You know, it's just so majestic. You forget all about yourself, you know, and you become one with the world around you. It's like, in that moment when you look around and you see the sky and you see the mountains, you know, I would say you're really not Kurt anymore. You know, it's like Kurt is forgotten about. And, you know, you become one with your surroundings, and it feels so liberating. You know, it's just so liberating. You know, it's important. You know, after the hike, I come home, I get back to my office, I have to read my emails, they're all addressed to me, you know, I answer them. So I go back to being Kurt. But, you know, when I go hiking, you know, I'm not Kurt so much. You know, I was reading about this guy who, a British man, who decided to live by himself up in Scotland, up in the wilderness area of Scotland, for like 3 years or something. And he said he brought a pencil and paper, a lot of paper, a lot of pencils. And he didn't bring a typewriter, but he does a lot of writing by hand. And he said he was planning on writing a book. And the longer he stayed out there in that wilderness area, the less important it seemed to write this book. And the more he just enjoyed being present with the world around him. And he said, you know, it was the strangest thing. He said, you know, he's like a philosopher or something. But he said the longer he stayed out there, the fewer thoughts he had. He said, you know, after a while, he said, my mind just became very quiet, you know, and I really didn't have an impulse to write, and I didn't really feel that I didn't have any thoughts, really, you know. It was quite a shock for him. But he also talked about how powerfully connected he felt to everything around him. You know, I was reading this article about him in The Guardian, and his experiences. I can't remember how long he stayed out there. But it's not so different if you like to hike, you know. When it's physically demanding to walk up a 45-degree slope all day. You're covered with sweat, but you look around and it's like you forget the self. You forget that little self that says, what do I have for breakfast today, you know? And then if you don't have any milk for your coffee, you get upset, right? It's like, oh no, you know, I've got to go to the store and get some milk right away. You know, there's this other way of living that's so majestic, right? And you know, when you're on the trail, if you're hiking, you know, people buy these freeze-dried dinners, and you know, it's you could get all kinds of things. You know, I'm a vegetarian, so now they have quite a range. I can get pad thai. I can get, you know, you just heat water and add it to this foil pouch, right? And there's all, but you know, by around day three, you don't really care what you're eating. It doesn't really matter. You know, it's just, you just need some food to keep going. And it's nice to have the pad thai on day three of your hike. But, you know, if it were just rice, it would be fine. You know, it's just like, whatever. Because you're in a different place. You're outside of your, we would say in Zen, outside of your small self. You know, and I'm not putting down the small self. You know, it's important to be skillful at being a self. So, you know, if you're in a relationship with somebody, if you're in a romantic relationship, you know, you want to be able to handle that relationship skillfully, intelligently, and compassionately. You know, if you're, you know, when I'm an English teacher, when I put my English teacher hat on, you know, I act 100% the English teacher. And that's the role I have to play, and I want to be skillful at it. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you get into this other place where you realize, like that man who was living in the wilderness in Scotland, you realize, you know, that's a very small part of who I am. It's important to be skillful at being a self, but, you know, in a certain way, it's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, we have this other deeper self that we access sometimes. And, you know, one of the reasons people go hiking, for example, even though it's so physically demanding, is that they may not consciously think this way, but they're tapping into that other deeper self. You know, when you climb up a mountain and you've been walking for 2 or 3 hours, you don't look at your watch every 15 minutes and say, you know, basically, how long have I been walking? You know, at some point, time just disappears. You get tired and you have to sit down, but it's like you're not counting the minutes anymore. It's like you enter a different mental state where time has a different character. You know, if you stay out in the wilderness, if you go on a long hike for 7 days, you know, after a while, you know, time, you don't even know where your watch is and you don't care. And time has this totally different quality. You know, so we definitely have more to ourselves, more to our minds, than we're normally aware of. And, you know, if we're lucky enough in life to have gotten outside of that small self and encountered the big self, that's a wonderful thing. You know, another way you can encounter your big self is by doing meditation. You know, when I was living in Seattle, I had just finished my undergraduate school. You know, I was working in a number of different jobs, and I think I was, you know, very confused about what I wanted to do with my life, and I think I was a little depressed, you know. And I had to, I heard about, there was a Tibetan center associated with the Shambhala organization in Seattle near the university. It was right on, if you don't know Seattle very well, it was, if you do know Seattle, it was on 45th, right next to the university. And they had a house, and it was very Tibetan, you know. The house was, you went inside, and there were those beautiful Tibetan colors, and they had a lot of yellows and reds, and the meditation cushions looked like our cushions, but they were all sort of deep burgundy. So it was like a festival for your eye, very nice. And I started, I had read some books on meditation, and I started meditating there, and it made me feel a little better. But then one day I ran into somebody there. There wasn't a resident teacher at that time at that Tibetan place, who said, you know, this Japanese monk, this very famous Japanese meditation teacher, has just come to Seattle, and he's holding zazen, he's holding meditation practice on Wednesday nights at the university. So I found the address, and I went there, and I started sitting. And I had only been sitting for about a month, and this woman whose name is Wendy Nakao, she now directs, she's been the abbot of the LA Zen Center for a long time. But she came up to me and said, would you like to go to Sesshin? And she was so charming and so beautiful that I said, yes. I said, yes. What's Sesshin? So anyway, I signed up for a 7-week meditation retreat with the Seattle Zen Center. And it was a little bit like signing up for a 50-mile hike, you know. It had some of those same characteristics, you know. On day one of the Sesshin, you know, in a way, you're sort of walking up a 45-degree angle slope, you know. People get a little tired after doing, say, 8 hours of meditation. In fact, you know, if you the first time you go on a 50-mile hike, you know, about an hour into the hike, you might be thinking, what have I done? You know, I'll never make 50 miles. I can barely get through, you know, 3 miles. But, you know, you get through the first 10 miles, and then you get through the next 10 miles. That's how it works with hiking. Well, it's very similar with a sesshin, you know. You might be through half the first day, and you might think, oh my gosh, what have I done, you know. But you just keep coming back to the cushion, and pretty soon the first day is over with. And then, you know, you come to the second day, and usually, just like with a hike, you know, on the second day of a 50-mile hike, you're tired, right? First day was a challenge. The second day, you're tired because the first day was so challenging. And you get up and you think, oh my gosh, what have I signed up for, you know? But you get through the second day, and actually what happens as you go on is that you find you have energy reserves you didn't know you had. You know, so by like the third or fourth day of a long hike, you realize, I can do this. You know, where I don't know where this energy is coming from, but it's coming. And Sesshin is very much like that. You know, you go through the first day, and you know, it's challenging, your legs get tired. Second day, you think, oh my gosh, I'm out of gas. But somehow you get through, and then you get into the third day. And, you know, as I said, just like with a hike, you know, you begin to find you have this energy reserve, or this source of energy you didn't know you had. It's like when you think, this is as far as I can go, you realize that there's something in you that can take you farther. And this is not, this is, as philosophers say, this is non-trivial. This is quite important. You know, when we live in the small self, we think we know who we are, and we think we know what our limits are. You know, but when we do something like a 50-mile hike, or we go to Sesshin, we have a chance to encounter our deeper self. You know, and this self is the self that I discovered when I went hiking with the Boy Scouts when I was like 11 years old or something. You know, I didn't know that I would like hiking, being out in the mountains so much. Right? It was something that was not part of my familiar world. And if somebody had asked me, why do you like hiking in the mountains? In fact, I actually had a girlfriend who, and I took her on a hike once, and she said, I said, we're going to walk from here to here. I had the map, and I said, it's a 7-mile hike, you know, and about 3 miles in, she said, why do we have to do this? You know, why 7? Why not just 3? Let's stop here. You know, she just couldn't get into it, right? Part of the hiking mentality is you make your choice. You say, I'm going to go from here to here, and it's an adventure trying to get there. She was not into it. And later she just said, I just don't see what you like about this, you know. She said, I don't get it, you know. So, you know, I understand, you know, it's not everybody's cup of tea, you know. But for me, it spoke powerfully. And she actually said, why do you like to do this? Why, you know, it's punishing, right? You have to walk up a mountain, you know, you're going 7 miles, you could stop at 3 miles, you know. And I said, well, but there's more water, you know, we're going, there'll be a spring there. And of course, that's not the reason I'm going 7 miles, because there's a spring. The spring is the excuse for going 7 miles. You know, I like to challenge myself, right? Because, you know, when you challenge yourself, you get out of that small self and into that big self. And, you know, after the end of a day of hiking, you don't care if you're going to eat pad thai or beef stroganoff. Who cares, you know? You know, you're in a different place, and it's so liberating. See, well, Sesshin is like that too. You know, by around day 3 or 4 of Sesshin, you're in a very different place. You know, it can happen here on a Saturday to some degree as well, you know. You know, by the, say, second round of sitting, you know, your legs are hurting, you're tired, but, you know, your mind is changing. You're entering that big mind that doesn't have a name, you know, it doesn't have a birthday, it doesn't have any deadlines, you know. It's just 100% natural. You know, it's like unfolding spontaneously. It's like the weather. It's like the mountains, see? I mean, getting in touch with that self is worth a lot to me. And I'm not surprised that Zazen caught on, that I found Zazen so engaging, is so much like some of the other things I do. You know, when you sit down on a cushion and your legs begin to hurt, nobody likes their legs to hurt. You know, when I go to a sesshin, I've been doing this for 40 years, my legs still hurt around day 3. You know, early in the morning, we have long sits at sesshin, and, you know, by the third sit, my legs are hurting. But, you know, if you just keep coming back to the breath, and you come back to the breath, you get into a deeper place. It's like walking up that mountain. And then the vista from that place is so beautiful. It's open in all directions. You know, no, we say in Zen, no boundaries are seen. You know, it's okay to live in the small self. It's okay to be a person. In fact, it's you know, it's important psychologically to be a person and to be good at being a person. You know, it's nice to have people recognize you. And, you know, I when I go to conferences, people will come up to me and say, oh, I read your article. I really like that article, you know. And it's nice to know I can write something that people read and that they enjoy. You know, that's important. And I'm glad I've worked really hard to be a good writer. And when I get a compliment, I feel good about myself. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that's perfectly excellent, you know. But if you just live in that place, you miss out on a lot. You know, there's this other self you discover in various ways. You know, Zen is not everybody's way. But when you discover that bigger self, it's so liberating. And it's so energizing, right? And you realize, you know, I don't have to live all the time in that little self. I can live a bigger life. You know, so Zen, people who practice Zen, you know, a lot, you know, understand that they can live this bigger life. You know, and they spend a lot of time there. It's important to be Jim or to be Bill, but from the Zen standpoint, you're not knowing yourself fully if that's all you know, or if you spend too much of your time there. You know, I think we all spend, especially in the modern world, we all spend too much of our time with the small self. You know, I'm sure you've read the articles in the newspaper, but they say, people who spend a lot of time on Facebook tend to be depressed. Now, there's a correlation between spending a lot of time on Facebook and being depressed. It may be that if you're depressed, you just go onto Facebook because you can't think of anything else to do with your time. But it also might be that Facebook makes people depressed. You know, people put their selfies on Facebook, or they send their selfies to each other. And a selfie is a highly contrived image of yourself, right? You know, you could say, "Here I am in Aruba having fun with a big smile on your face." You know, and the picture shows somebody in Aruba with a big smile on his face. We don't really know if he's happy or not. But, you know, it forces us to begin to look at ourselves, you know, through the eyes of other people. It's almost like a mental illness where you're constantly imagining how you appear to others and you're worried about how you appear to others. You know, and you worry that you're not living the life that others would find interesting or, beautiful. And you know, when you begin to live for the opinion of others, you become a prisoner, right? You know, it happens to all of us to some degree. You know, we all become prisoners of social expectations to some degree. But when we really internalize those expectations, that becomes a problem. You know, I knew a professor in my department who retired and was really very down on himself. You know, he had published, his field was drama. And this guy was a genius, right? He wrote this book that I think Princeton University Press put out on drama, modern drama, and it was very successful. And then he wrote another book on drama that wasn't quite as, you know, didn't get the rave reviews. And then that kind of traumatized him. And for the rest of his career, he was trying to write this brilliant book, and he never finished the book, and then he retired. And, you know, I'd had lunch with him before he retired, and he was kind of down on himself. He said, "Yeah, you know, I only wrote two books, you know, and really only the first one was any good, right?" And it was so sad to see him treat himself that way because, you know, basically both of the books, anybody else would have been happy to write the second book, but he'd gotten such rave reviews for the first book. And then when the second book didn't get the same rave reviews, he decided, "I'm going to write the most brilliant book in the world." And he sat down. And by the way, if you want to give yourself a writer's block, just say, "What I am going to write now is going to be super brilliant." Right? And your death, you're never finished, right? Hey, you know, that's a fatal mistake, right? You know, when you write, you just have to say, "I'm going to roll these ideas around and see where they go, and I don't know where they're going to go, and they may not go where I want, and this may or may not be publishable, right? You know, but I'm going to do my best. It's just like going to the gym. I'm not going to turn into a muscle man, but I'll have a few muscles, and that'll make me a little bit more respectable, you know. So you do your best, but, you know, my friend sat down to write the greatest book on drama ever written, and so the poor guy spent like 15 years on this book. And, you know, it must, he actually had a drinking problem, you know, go on and on with this. He boxed himself in to such a degree. He held himself to such an impossibly high standard, right? That he could never meet it. And every time he wrote, it must have been like, well, this isn't brilliant. This isn't the most brilliant thing that anybody ever said about drama. You know, later in his life, he sort of gave up on writing the greatest book on drama. And just after he retired, he actually was a fan of this Scandinavian playwright, Ibsen. So he actually learned Norwegian and did some translations after he retired of Ibsen. And that's an amazing, it's like the 65-year-old guy learned Ibsen, learned Norwegian, and translated Ibsen. And he was working on stuff like that until he died at 86 or something. But, you know, when he'd kind of given up on being the greatest drama scholar of all times, he actually did something that he just kind of liked and found interesting, and he was actually much happier. Well, I would say he was listening to his true nature. You know, if you said, well, you know, we have got plenty of Ibsen translations, you know, we don't need another one. Or if you said, you're 65, what's wrong with you? Why are you trying to learn Norwegian? Nobody learns a second language at 65. You know, who cares what people think? He was doing what spoke to him from a deeper place. And he was no longer doing it, I think, to be the greatest drama scholar of all times. He was acting from that other place. He was going up his own mountain, you know. And he had found his mountain, I think, you know. And so that's wonderful. You know, we all have to find the mountain. And the thing about the mountain is it's not what society says. It's what makes us feel alive, you know. And you know, I have been doing Zazen for 40 years because it's like going... It's actually better than going to the Tetons for me. You know, I have many small self problems just like everybody else, and I'm not running away from them when I sit down on the cushion. But I definitely benefit from having a bigger perspective. You know, I definitely benefit from entering that place where I look around and there's no boundaries in all directions, and I feel, you know, totally alive, and, you know, 18 years old, and my mind is luminous and bright, and I feel unbounded, and, you know, I get off the cushion and I go back to my job, and, you know, I feel I'm better in my life because I have this, you know. So, you know, we're a little bit strangers to ourselves. And, you know, knowing yourself could mean knowing what you like for breakfast. And it could mean, knowing what kind of jeans you like to wear. But, you know, in Zen, we say there's a small self and there's a big self. And, you know, Buddhism in general and Zen in particular are about discovering the big self. You know, you might be 32 years old, and you might be 67 years old, and you might be 72 years old. You know, and you might have been born in Philadelphia, and you might have been born in Tel Aviv, and you might have been born in L.A. But you also have a self that is ageless and timeless and has no birth and no death, like those mountains. So please discover that self. I'm so glad you came to sit today, and I hope you continue to sit. You know, people in New Year, this is the first sit of the New Year. People make New Year's resolutions. They say, well, I resolve to do such and such, you know. But, you know, it has to come from that place deep inside of you. You know, they say like 80% of New Year's resolutions are forgotten by the second month, right? So, you know, it's not coming from the right place. If you got up this morning to sit here, I think something inside you, something very deep inside you, said, get up and come to sit. And I think you should trust that voice and listen to that voice all your life. You know, because that's the, you know, you're not getting any money for coming here. It doesn't help your public image. People won't think better of you if you come here to sit. You don't benefit from this in any way. And that those are all why it's so liberating. It's so liberating. You know, it's not something people expect you to do. Those orders came from a place deep inside you that said, get up and sit. If you are true to your true nature, you will never regret it. You will never regret it. And if you're not true to your true nature, sooner or later you will regret it. So, Daibai asked Master Basso, or Matsu, ancestor horse, what is the Buddha? See, now, you know, in the people understood, you know, this was a Buddhist culture. So, people thought of the Buddha as this historical person who was a special, you know, once in a kalpa person, deeply enlightened. People thought of the Buddha as like basically divine being. And there were statues of the Buddha in the temple, and so on and so on. And people studied scripture and so on and so on. So Daibai says, "What is the Buddha?" And Daibai says, "You know, forget about the sutras. Forget about the statues. This very mind is the Buddha." Daibai might have left that interview thinking, this very mind, but how can my mind be the Buddha? You know, I'm worried about this and that. I feel like I'm not making progress as a monk. You know, I'm not a senior monk in the ranks of monks in the monastery. You know, I can't get along with my bunk mates, you know. I feel like a failure, blah, blah, blah. How can that ordinary mind be Buddha? Well, you know, basically he has yet to discover the mountain inside himself. So that's what this koan is about. He has to find that, the Buddha in himself. Mumon's comment, if you directly grasp Matsu's meaning, you wear the Buddha's clothes, you eat the Buddha's food, you speak the Buddha's words, you do the Buddha's deeds. That is, you are the Buddha himself if you live that life, live from that place. However, alas, Daibai misled not a few people into taking the mark on the balance for the weight itself. How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? In other words, you know, you can get too attached to the idea of enlightenment. You know, there are people who practice meditation for a while and say, I've never had enlightenment. You know, I've never had enlightenment. You say, well, when you sit down on the cushion, do you ever get to this place where everything disappears and you feel no boundaries are seen and you feel alive and you feel timeless? Yes. What's the problem? How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? You know, that now we're back in the realm of social expectations, right? Of playing a role, being what others expect us to be instead of being truly free. If a person of understanding hears anyone say, this great mind is the Buddha, he will cover his ears and rush away. Mumon's verse, the blue sky and the bright day, no more searching around. What is the Buddha, you ask? With loot in your pocket, you declare yourself innocent.